This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again it is time to do our weekly feature, Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions may be directed to radioprogram@AOL.com. That's the destination for questions related to nutrition and medicine and overall health and well-being. Call that intelligent medicine. And today with me, Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin, who herself has a weekly podcast as part of our intelligent medicine series. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good. Well, big week because we moved the Hoffman Center this weekend, and I gotta really congratulate my staff. Is that I was minimally involved, and they did a beautiful job. And here I am sitting at my new desk, right opposite Columbus Circle here on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. It's a new location. I've 10 years on the roughly Midtown, Chelsea neighborhood, two 10-year leases at 30th Street, and then another 10-year lease at 27th Street, and now here on 58th Street and 8th Avenue in a new office. And, you know, so the test today is, will the sirens that, you know, go, you know, the sirens that occasionally people get,
Sixth Avenue.
People get a little New York ambiance when they listen to these podcasts, because we get, we are all about reality, and this is like a reality show. And part of that reality is that you hear these intrusive sounds of New York in the background. And here we are perched a little higher above the traffic, not to say that we won't hear anything, but
it's quiet.
It's quiet. It's blissfully quiet here.
I hope it's true. I hope it stays like that.
Yeah.
Because after a while, the Sixth Avenue ambulances. Wow.
Yeah. It's like emergency alley there.
You know?
So anyway, so here we are, and I'm physically in the new office. We're very excited. And the story that I want to touch upon before we get to phone calls. You can see I'm in like...
You're in radio mode.
I'm in radio mode here. The weekend show is about phone calls. Is this. Headline. Osteoarthritis could be prevented with good diet and exercise. Okay. Now, this is a duh story to us.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people believe that osteoarthritis is a matter of wear and tear. You know, is that, you know, you just... It's like, you know, too much mileage on the knees, the ankles... you know, ultimately you got osteoarthritis. But I have to say that the vast majority of our listeners and patients don't walk on their knuckles. Maybe a few are what, you know, we call them knuckle draggers.
Or on their shoulders.
Right. You know, the term knuckle draggers. Right. But the point being is that they develop osteoarthritis of the hands and fingers.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, maybe to some extent that's repetitive stress injury, you know, from people involved in some kind of mechanical work. But the vast majority of us, maybe we're tapping out on a keyboard. It's not that, we're not really punishing our fingers and our hands. And yet we develop osteoarthritis of the hands commonly. And so it's not just a wear and tear thing. It's a metabolic disorder, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we're lacking nutrients, primarily things like what you would get in bone broth, the collagen, the
unusual
gelatin.
Nutrients like copper, manganese.
Yes, you know, these are all terribly important for cartilage repair.
But there's also this thing about toxic fat.
The fat that produces is responsible for insulin resistance. That's also producing inflammatory cytokines. So here's what they say. During their expert review, researchers at the University of Surrey in England identified a crucial link between metabolism and arthritis. Metabolic changes caused by a poor diet and a sedentary lifestyle trigger the genetic reprogramming of cells in the body and joints. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So he says, the lead author on this, Professor Ali Mobasheri, he's a professor of musculoskeletal physiology. He says, quote, "For too long, osteoarthritis has been known as the wear and tear disease, and it's been assumed that it is part and parcel of getting older, inevitable. However, this is not the case, and what we have learned is that we can control and prevent the onset of this painful condition. It is important never to underestimate the significance of a healthy diet and lifestyle, as not only does it impact on our general well-being, but can alter the metabolic behavior of our cells, tissues, and organs, leading to serious illnesses."
Yeah.
So, you know, this, I think, is a clarion call for diet in the management of osteoarthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that, you know, I've looked at some studies. You know, I worry because I put in a lot of miles, you know, cycling and particularly running. And I run on hard concrete in New York because there's no way around it.
Yeah,
and,
that's the worst stuff.
You know, I have to say that there a lot of the studies say that moderate, even to relatively intense exercise, helps to regenerate cartilage in the knees. It's sort of like the stress that's beneficial, you know. I mean, it's not no pain, no gain. Don't run through an injury. Don't push yourself, you know, push the envelope.
No.
Don't, you know, I see these people wearing these very cumbersome knee braces and I feel their pain, you know. Why are they running with
they
these braces?
They shouldn't be running with that on at all. Okay.
They, you know, that doesn't make sense. But, you know, I put in, knock wood, a lot of miles and, you know, thank goodness my knees are holding up.
That's good.
And I think in doing a large part of the fact, I've been taking glucosamine, chondroitin, with MSM, and lots of fish oil and curcumin, and I'm on a very clean diet.
Mm-hmm. That, bone broths, all of that.
Yep.
Wonderful stuff.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that is our story of the week. And let's get to questions.
Okay. We've got an email from Elizabeth. "Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Thank you for the great information you generously share. Have heard that with fatty liver, you should avoid vitamin A, and that vitamin A could cause lung cancer in former smokers and present smokers. My 65-year-old husband is a former smoker and has fatty liver. Among the supplements we take is a mega food multi that has 2,500 IU of vitamin A as alpha and beta carotene with mixed carotenoids. Could this be harmful to him?"
Okay, so the study in question, a very classic study and a disappointing study because the contention was that the vitamin A, especially in the form of beta carotene, could prevent cancer in smokers. And they tested it out. They took just beta carotene and they administered to smokers and they found that in smokers, it somewhat increased the risk of cancer.
Yeah.
But what of interest is that in Finland, you know, the nights are very long. I tell you, it's crazy up there because I was just in Belgium and the sun went down at like 10:15 and it's not even June 21st yet.
Because you're so far north.
And Finland's a lot further north. And so it's pretty cold and dark in the winter. And what do? You drink a lot. So these smokers were big drinkers and they probably had pretty damaged livers.
Yeah.
And the net effect of too much vitamin A. We have to distinguish between the pre-vitamin A and vitamin A, right? Retinol is the formed vitamin A.
Yes.
And pre-vitamin A is beta-carotene or the mixed carotenoids.
Right.
Which have benefits in and of themselves other than being a precursor to vitamin A.
Mm-hmm.
But so in this group, they found that there was an increased risk of cancer. Now, I have to say, anecdotally, I will tell you that this is just an N-of-1 study, but I had a neighbor who was an older guy. He's long since passed away. This must be like 25 years ago or 30 years ago. And he developed precancerous lesions on his tongue, you know, which were called leukoplakia. Leukoplakia is a precancerous lesion. And he was a smoker. And so, you know, he stuck out his tongue at me once on a driveway and, you know, got this people ask me for advice, you know, so I said, oh, yikes, you know, what are you going to do there? I said, here, take some beta carotene. So I told him to take 25,000 international units of beta carotene, exactly as in the study, you know, that was done there. I may have told him to take 50,000, which is quite a lot.
Okay.
Anyway, you know, I don't see him for a few months, and then I see him again, and he says, darn if those things didn't go away. And I said, I hope you stopped smoking. And he says, no.
Ah.
I go out, you know, my wife yells at me, but I go out, you know, behind the apple tree in the yard, and I, you know, have a couple of cigarettes here and there. But that is promising. And in this particular case, this person is not taking just synthetic beta-carotene.
Right.
They're taking a plant-based mixed carotenoid, you
made
know.
Made of carrots.
Right.
50 milligrams of
and
carrots.
And that may be beneficial. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about that is that, you know, if you took retinol vitamin A, that might be bad for the liver.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that this type is bad for the liver.
Exactly. Because the body determines how much of it is going to be converted.
Nice. Correct.
Into vitamin A anyway. Now, Elizabeth, my question for you, your 65-year-old husband, former smoker, yay, has fatty liver. We need to take care of the fatty liver.
Yes.
I like the idea of a...
By the way, I did a wonderful podcast recently with Dr. Robert Roundtree on the subject of fatty liver. That's something you ought to listen to because it's really great information about all the things that are helpful.
Wonderful, wonderful. Diet change, absolutely. If your husband is eating too many carbohydrates, his triglycerides are going to be high. If your husband is a drinker, his triglycerides are going to be high.
Too much in the way of even fruit and fruit juice.
Fruit,
you know, fructose.
Fruit juice. Yeah.
And certainly soda. Soda is a real culprit here.
Right. So these are the things you want to watch out for, Elizabeth. So, and never, we would never recommend a true vitamin A above.
To someone with fatty liver.
Exactly.
I'm very conservative about vitamin A because of...
It's great for immunity. It's great for eyes, all of that, but you have to take in... to consideration everything else going
right.
on.
And it some particular concerns in pregnancy at high doses.
Right.
And there's even some literature on high-dose vitamin A and osteoporosis, promoting osteoporosis.
Wow.
I think it was something like 25,000 of vitamin A or maybe even less promoted bone loss.
I remember back when this was shortly after Dr. Atkins died and I was consulting at Atkins Nutritionals. Somebody there was telling me that for immune support, if you feel like you're coming down with a cold, I know you and I recommend 40 to 50,000 IU of vitamin D for three consecutive days.
Yeah.
Back then, it was about 100,000 IU of vitamin A.
That was a Carlton Fredericks thing.
For two, where they got it from.
You know, maybe a short burst of vitamin A.
Okay.
Although I have to say vitamin D, the literature is more robust on its immune supportive effects.
Yeah. I'd still be a little bit afraid of that big a dose of vitamin A.
Yeah.
Okay. Elizabeth, thank you for your question. Best of luck to your husband. Okay. We have an email from Bo with an article from the New York Times, and he says, you guys should talk about this.
Okay.
Tom Fleming, a two-time winner of the New York City Marathon in the 70s, who's trained as many as 200 miles a week, died in April in Montclair, New Jersey. He was 65. Now,
did he die while running?
No, he did not. He died apparently of a heart attack, and he was found unconscious near the track in his car.
So he was probably running, but he felt uncomfortable or sick, and maybe he was going to, you know, sit down for a while. Okay, so...
Now, the thing about Fleming, which is very interesting in reading this article... many of today's elite marathon runners train about 120 miles a week. How much did you train? I know you've done the marathon and stuff.
I trained very inadequately.
For the marathon. And that was a long time ago for you. You do more the triathlete stuff.
And,
lately.
You know, at most, I'll run anywhere from 2 to 4 miles, and I get in a few 6-mile runs here and there.
Yeah.
Because a triathlon is 6 miles, so I got to be able to run 6 miles.
Right.
But that's not very much. I mean, some people may be impressed by that, but true runners, that's very wussy. But you know, I'm conservative about running because
yeah.
it's very traumatic
yeah.
to the joints and to
sure.
the body. And I'm 64, and you know, So how much did he run?
So yeah, according to
I mean,
this article,
he's my age. He's
your age, right. He was, and many elite marathon runners train about 120 miles a week. But Mr. Fleming, according to this Times article, preferred to run 140 to 150 for at least 2 weeks. Yeah. And for at least 2 weeks during his career, raised the distance to 200. Now, chairman of New York Roadrunners, George Hirsch, said he slept, ran, ate.
Right.
Which is pretty much. And while many elite runners train twice a day, Tom, some days he did three runs. And I know a few days he did four runs. So, and even after a Boston Marathon, he went back home and trained some more.
Wow.
Because he came in like second or third place.
So, you know,
wow.
Other than generating a little Schadenfreude, which means joy in the suffering of others by couch potatoes, this is an instructive tale. Because here's a guy who clearly is a little bit one-dimensional in his obsession with athleticism and running. And I get it because it's really it's invigorating.
Yeah.
Also you know, it's a great ego blast that you're able to do this. And as you get older and older, the fact that you're able to maintain a high level of fitness is gratifying.
It is.
You know.
It is.
But there is such a thing as the march of time, and you know, one has to have a realization that. There are some factors that are, shall we say, limiting. This story is a little reminiscent of Micah True, who was a legendary runner, who was memorialized in a book entitled, let's see, the book was Born to Run. Born to Run. Christopher McDougall wrote a best-selling book, Born to Run, profiling Micah True, who was not just a marathoner, he was an ultra marathoner, and he used to run in the canyons of where he mimicked the running style of the Tarahumara Indians of the highlands of Mexico. And he was a barefoot runner.
Oh, and they best way to run.
Ah. And they found him dead in 2012 at the tender age of 59. He was found, you know, in some, you know, desert canyon. Apparently, he had, you know, died suddenly, and you know, he went missing. He went out for one run one day, never came back, and they sent out a search party, and they found him dead. So this is a concern because they've actually done studies on these types of guys, and I don't want to be that guy. You know, the first rule of running and competition and races is don't die.
Yeah.
Because
please.
That makes the whole thing pointless, right? So, yeah, I mean, if that's your exit scenario and you want that, you want it, you know, fine, you'll go out with a blaze of glory. But it's not particularly, that's not my, you know, goal. When you run at that level, you tend to develop cardiomyopathy, like an enlarged heart.
Yes.
It's actually, I've seen this in some of our top athletes, is they have what's called ventricular hypertrophy, which is actually similar to what happens when you have hypertension. You have a thickening of the wall, and it looks identical to the kind of thickening of the wall that you have as a hypertensive, but they refer to it as, you know, runner's ventricular hypertrophy or athletic heart.
I want to clarify this a little more.
Sure.
We strengthen, when we exercise, we strengthen our muscles,
right?
When we do this type of aerobic activity, our heart is also a muscle.
Right.
And that's another reason for the enlargement that may occur.
But there's a point of diminishing returns on that.
Yeah.
It's one thing to have an athletic heart, but the heart actually can overexpand, and it can then result in a susceptibility to arrhythmias. And they actually did it was JAMA or New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago. They looked at these really, not just marathoners, because for these guys, a marathon is like a, you know, walking the dog to the mailbox.
Right.
These are guys like do three consecutive marathons. They run all day and all night and the next day, you know, and Incredible feats of athleticism. But they tend to have a higher rate of arrhythmias and atrial fibrillation. And this is like being the scenario of this guy, is that this guy probably had a sudden death due to a cardiac arrhythmia.
Wow.
He felt uncomfortable. He sat in the car and he was dead.
That was
the, you know, I mean, there's also the Jim Fix phenomenon. Jim Fix was a guy who was a big exerciser. He really was launched sort of the, you know, this notion of jogging.
Yeah.
It was such a foreign notion. It was like, you're going to go jogging. When I was like young, it was like, who did that? Maybe track stars did it. Now everybody's jogging.
Jogging, yeah.
I mean, I used to see in front of my house, the guys from UCLA would come running and say, well, that's an aberration. Now it's like, everybody, you know, 75-year-olds were running in front of my house in Santa Monica when I revisited it last time.
Wow.
Jim Fix really helped to launch that revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And he died, and then they did an autopsy of him. They found he had very bad atherosclerosis.
Wow.
Part of the problem was that he was very, very A-plus on the athleticism side, but on the diet side, he was into that carb-loading paradigm. He ate whatever
that's
he could.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
And that's what it still is to some degree.
Yeah. So you can't...
You can't run
from heart disease.
Yeah.
But you can't run from heart disease.
But you can't run as long and as much as Fleming did without a whole lot more carbohydrates, too. So you have to kind of wonder.
Yeah, it's possible that there's some over-fueling thing. I also had an occasion to treat a runner who was a very famous runner in his day. And he was, by the time I saw him, he was absolutely a mess. And he wasn't that old. He was in his 70s. But he was extraordinarily debilitated. And it's almost as if, like, if you buy a car and you drive it, you know, 120 miles an hour too much, you're going to burn out the transmission and the pistons. And he had... such a burnout. The other thing about it is he was a vegan vegetarian. So he was sort of running on fumes, in my opinion. He wanted to demonstrate that you could be a vegetarian and an ultra runner. And he was, I mean, this guy could barely lift a kitten. He was so weak and debilitated.
His body used all those amino acids, broke down his muscle for them to eat itself for dinner.
Catabolic. And so... And that's why, you know, I think as you get older, I think you need a balance between, you know, endurance and strength.
Yeah.
And, of course, flexibility that comes in with doing, you know, stretching and yoga.
Yeah. Well.
So, I mean, thanks for the something to tee off on.
Right.
You know, this is.
Rest in peace, Thomas Fleming.
Worth discussing.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a phenomenon that is a... teachable moment. It's a teachable moment for those of us who strive for athletic achievement and for overall wellness, especially as we get older.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Bo, for that article.
Thank you, Bo. So we're going to pause because we divide these podcasts into two parts. And Layla, give us a preview of what we're going to talk about in part two.
Help. I'm noticing bubbles in my urine.
That's a frequent complaint that we will address in part two. It's, you know... too much beer? Too much champagne? Possibly. No, that's not the cause.
No.
When we return, bubbles in the urine, what does it signify? I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.